They are elected by you, I am elected by you. I am constrained as they are constrained by a system that our founders put in place.
The founders separated power because they knew it was the best way to protect our citizens.
Keep your eye on the ball. Structure is destiny.
This is Necessary and Proper, the podcast of the Federal Society's Article 1 Initiative. All views expressed on this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the Federal Society.
Well, hello, everyone, and welcome to this Federalist Society virtual event. I'm Caroline Bryant, and I'm the Deputy Director of Networks of the Federalist Society. Today, we're excited to host this webinar on defining anti-Semitism, a debate on free speech and civil rights. Our moderator today is Aaron Friedman. Aaron is a special counsel at Sullivan & Cromwell and a visiting scholar at the Hoover Institution. He's also a former senior tax counsel to the Committee on Ways and Means and a former senior advisor to the Assistant Treasury Secretary for Tax Policy. After our speakers give their presentation, we will turn to you, the audience, for questions. If you have a question, please enter it into the Q&A function at the bottom of your Zoom window. We'll do our best to answer as many as we can. Finally, I'll note that, as always, all expressions of opinion today are those of our guest speakers, not the Federalist Society. With that, Aaron, thank you so much for joining us, and the floor is yours.
Hi, good morning. I thank everybody for joining us on this timely topic to speak about the legislation with regards to anti-Semitism and free speech concerns. The Anti-Semitism Awareness Act passed the House in 2024 by a vote of 320-91. Senate Majority Leader Schumer did not put the bill on the floor. This Congress, the legislation has not seen any floor action. There was a Senate help markup on April 30th, which turned rather acrimonious, and the legislation is yet to be reported out of the committee. According to FBI statistics, almost 70% of crimes targeting religion in 2024 were against Jews. And that was 16% of all hate crimes, according to statistics by the Anti-Defamation League. Anti-Semitic assaults and other incidents have gone up by about 9 times since a decade ago. So under Title VI of the civil rights laws, as applied to education, no person in the U.S. shall be, on the grounds of race, color, or national origin, be excluded from participation and be denied the benefits of or be subjected to discrimination under any program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. The legislation, which this Congress is S-558, in the House, which has 45 co-sponsors, and H.R. 1007, which has 85 co-sponsors in the House, would generally apply the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, or IHRA, working definition of anti-Semitism for purposes of interpreting Title VI of the Civil Rights Act. But it wouldn't change the interpretation of the act or when it's supposed to be applied. Today, we are very excited to have with us two authorities on this issue, or these issues. Will Creeley is the legal director of FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. He's been with FIRE since graduating NYU in 2003, and NYU Law in 2006. Professor Eugene Kondorovich is professor of law and director of the Center for Middle East and International Law at George Mason University and Antonin Scalia Law School. He graduated from the University of Chicago Law School and clerked for Judge Richard Posner on the Seventh Circuit. He's also a senior research fellow at Heritage's Margaret Thatcher Center for Freedom. Eugene, hand it over to you.
Great. Thank you so much, Aaron, for organizing this. Thanks, Will, for talking to me. I want to set the stage a little and make clear that I think my position and Will's are not entirely antagonistic. For one, I'm not a supporter of this legislation, but not because I agree with Will, but because I disagree with Will. That is to say, Will sees this as having the potential to silence political speech. I think not only will not silence political speech, it will not do much to silence actual anti-Semitic prohibited speech, or do too much altogether, and thus the game is likely not worth the candle. At the same time, we might have also different starting points. So Aaron mentioned my biography, and you will see, you will have noted, I spent a lot of time at the University of Chicago, and Richard Epstein is my mentor and friend. And I agree intellectually with the position he laid out in his book, Forbidden Grounds. That is to say, to the extent that civil rights laws restrict speech because it could be harmful, hurtful, create a hostile work environment, etc., on the basis of otherwise protected characteristics, to the extent that it does that in the private setting, let's say amongst employees and employers, I consider it, and I think it should, there's a very strong argument that it's, that entire branch of civil rights law is unconstitutional. However, that is not our subject today. And today we're talking about, I'm stipulating for the purposes of our discussion, the law as it currently exists, in which case civil rights laws and the application of them through Title VI to universities in particular can in fact and do in fact restrict speech on the basis of various protected categories, race, religion, and so forth. And our question, the question of this bill, is how to instrumentalize that, how to operationalize that in the particular context of anti-Semitism. Now, nobody is in favor of anti-Semitism. Everybody's against anti-Semitism. So it's very easy to come out against anti-Semitism. 100 years ago, Henry Ford, in his newspaper, The Dearborn Independent, notorious for its series, The International Jew, complained that the term anti-Semitism is used indiscriminately and vituperatively against people like Henry Ford, who just wanted to, quote, discuss Jewish world power. In other words, we don't hate Jews because of an irrational hatred. We hate them because of the bad things they do in the world. And it's very important to point out that anti-Semitism has never really been this kind of caricatured anti-Semitism of, and most bigotries are not, of detesting people for no reason, just to be mean. But rather, Jews have always been condemned for what you might call things they do in the world, political things, creating Jesus, rejecting Jesus, creating communism, creating capitalism, practicing communism, practicing capitalism, lending money, not lending money, whatever the case may be. These are things, right? These are actions. But the way in which they are pinned upon Jews in an unrealistic, exaggerated way is what gives such claims the ability to be anti-Semitic. What the IRA definition does is it says that it is possible, not necessary, that consider perhaps that some criticism of Israel, and it gives some suggestions of what kind of criticism of Israel, in particular, criticism unlike criticism of any other country, criticism that applies different standards, could potentially be a form of anti-Semitism. As a matter of anti-discrimination law, this should not be controversial, because anti-discrimination law recognizes the use of proxies for discrimination. So if you discriminate against some group, that is a very high correlate for a protected class. But this is the idea of redlining, any kind of discriminatory business practices that will pick up, let's say, 95% African Americans, but are not selecting explicitly on the protected class, but rather on some correlate of it. The use of those proxies could potentially be a form of discrimination. Now, Israel is a not bad proxy for Jews in the world, because the state of Israel happens to be where the plurality, very close to the majority, of Jews reside, and whose existence which many of these attacks challenge, is a tenet of a broadly held tenet of Jewish belief. So attacks on Israel can be a proxy for attack. Now, that does not mean they always are. And that does not mean this gets to where Will and I think might agree. I believe 39 states now have adopted the IRA definition of anti-Semitism. If it's correct that the use of this definition of anti-Semitism is going to chill criticism of Israel, boy, is it poorly designed. Because criticism of Israel has flourished, is flourishing, I'm sure will continue to flourish. I see no evidence of harm to criticism of Israel, and it's certainly impossible to correlate with the increased passage of IRA definitions. In America, most universities have not been so quick to adopt IRA. Weirdly enough, in Europe, many universities have adopted IRA, one in five British universities, and that does not seem to correlate with less anti-Israel speech on British campuses than in American campuses. So, for example, blaming the Jewish state for the evils of the world is potentially a form of anti-Semitic statement. Now, again, Will and I probably share very common views about what ideally should be done with statements that are critical of people's ethnicity. But under existing law, if minority groups are protected, if one would be, for example, potentially able to get in trouble for statements about, you know, people from inner cities. Inner city is not a racial term. Inner city is a geographic place. So people from inner cities, they cause all the problems in the world. Then certainly not allowing a similar broad interpretation for criticism that could be veiled criticism of Jews, or not so veiled in some cases, leaves a gap and leaves Jewish students less protected. And I would say, given that we have these civil rights laws setting a higher bar for Jews to be protected on them, then that itself could in fact be a violation of equal protection. But because this pure anti-Semitism, we just don't like Jews because of their noses, this is not something that has ever existed. Right? And anti-Semitism has existed for a long time, and it has been made based on political claims, much like the ones we hear now about babies being killed. These are the standard tropes. So criticism of Israel, I think, is not in any danger. I would hate to see it in any danger. I myself don't think this, you know, bill is worth passing, because the problems of enforcement are just difficult, complicated, and the controversy that it generates probably exceeds any actual kind of practical enforcement benefit. But at the same time, I don't see massive problems under our existing legal system. Thanks. I think I said more than enough.
Well, it's been a pleasure to listen to Eugene's remarks. I'm pleased that we start off in more or less agreement as to where we might end up vis-a-vis the bill's practical utility. And I think that that's an interesting place to start. Before I go much further, I want to be clear about what the bill would do. The bill would adopt the IRA definition, just as Eugene says, and require its consideration when colleges and universities and other recipients of federal funding, educational institutions bound under Title VI, consider allegations of discriminatory harassment. The bill language, it specifically incorporates the IRA definition, and that's where the First Amendment problems begin. The definition posited by IRA, which was not intended to be used in this capacity, was rather used to and designed to be used to inventory instances of anti-Semitism in Europe, to assist with NGOs seeking to address that pernicious and longstanding problem. It was not intended to be backed by the force of government or to be used to police speech, as its lead author, Ken Stern, has repeatedly noted. The bill defines anti-Semitism in part as, quote, a certain perception of Jews. And really, there is no clearer evidence of the inherent vagueness, the problematic, unconstitutional vagueness of enshrining into law a general warning against a, quote, certain perception of Jews, just as it would be problematic to enshrine into federal law a discussion of a, quote, unquote, certain perception of any protected class. The problems are compounded by the bill's incorporation of a series of examples, which Eugene alluded to, which include almost in every instance, examples of core protected political speech, speech that might very well be considered by some, many, or even all of us to be anti-Semitic. But as we know in this country, to paraphrase the Chief Justice, we have chosen a different path to address speech that is hateful or hurtful. Rather than seeking top-down government bans, we answer speech we don't like with more speech. It's the classic civil libertarian approach. It is our national tradition. And I think to agree with the good professor, I think it's bound to be far more effective in the long run in addressing anti-Semitism. The professor noted that some of these laws are already on the books at the state level. And I think the professor is correct to note that so too flourishes expression that might be considered anti-Semitic, same with in Europe. The answer to anti-Semitism is more discussion and more education, not censoring speech. I think that the likely outcome of censoring speech not only is to introduce unconstitutional legislation that will be attacked and struck down in the courts, and properly so, but also to begin to invite a broader reconsideration of federal anti-discrimination laws. In other words, as Professor Eugene Volokh, your colleague at Hoover Institution, Aaron, has noted, that other groups might say, well, wait a second, we would also like a static, unchanging list of examples that might be referred to for evidence of discrimination. He, on his popular blog, The Volokh Conspiracy, posited a hypothetical involving the election of a President Harris and what a Palestinian version of the IRA definition might look like and how it might operate. And in so doing, instructs perhaps to others who might not otherwise be able to see it, the First Amendment problems here. In addition to the invocation and reliance on clearly protected speech, political speech, the bill has already encountered constitutional problems. One court, Federal District Court in Texas, has already found that the bill is viewpoint discriminatory in application and chills protected speech. At FIRE, where I work, we are continually seeing instances of the IRA definition being used to silence or investigate, punish protected speech. A law professor at the University of Kentucky, now under investigation for a petition he had created calling for action against Israel, is being investigated, a disciplinary investigation under the IRA definition. We have reports of student groups at Pennsylvania high schools, including a Jewish student group, who are no longer allowed to bring in invited speakers because those speakers might, under the IRA definition, voice criticism of the state of Israel. Likewise, we are seeing censorship of student groups who are protesting peacefully, exercising their First Amendment rights, who have been warned not to protest or not to say certain phrases because of the IRA definition. Again, this is textbook First Amendment violations. And again, to Eugene's larger point, I don't think it brings us any closer to actually addressing anti-Semitism. Finally, there's bipartisan opposition to the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act. It's rare that a piece of legislation earns criticism from folks as varied as Michelle Goldberg and Chris Rufo, David French and Bill Ackman, the Alliance Defending Freedom, and the American Civil Liberties Union. But that's exactly the coalition that has voiced opposition to the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, and it's because of its core unconstitutionality. So I would propose that a far better way forward, and my organization has advocated for it, instead of sacrificing the First Amendment and introducing a novel means of cracking down on core protected speech, I think that the far better solution would be to address the gap that Eugene identified by amending Title VI to explicitly include religion, by codifying into law the longstanding understanding of Title VI as addressing shared ethnic characteristics or perceived national origin and in a predominantly religious nation as grounds for Title VI's coverage. And finally, codifying into law the definition voiced by the Supreme Court, announced by the Supreme Court in 1999's Davis v. Monroe County Board of Education for discriminatory harassment, peer-on-peer discriminatory harassment in the federal anti-discrimination context. That is, speech that is so severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive that it denies the victim student access to an educational opportunity or benefit. That's a high bar, but one that protects speech that's protected by the First Amendment while actually addressing real discrimination. Finally, I know I've said that twice, but one, I mean it this time. Finally, it's worth noting at the outset that there's a variety of important, narrowly constructed, but important exceptions to the First Amendment protection. Violence is never protected. Discriminatory harassment, properly defined under the Davis standard, is not protected. Universities can and should address true threats, incitement to violence, again, properly defined. And universities can enforce reasonable time, place, and manner regulations on their campuses that allow for protected speech, but also ensure that university students can study. No parts of campus can be blocked from certain ethnic groups. If folks need to use the library, they have to be allowed to use the library, those kinds of things. But other than that, the First Amendment protects speech that, again, some, many or most of us might find anti-Semitic. And that's the way it should be in our free country.
So proponents of the legislation, for example, Congressman Lawler, who's sponsored it, say that the legislation doesn't address speech. It addresses actions such as blocking access to students on racial or religious grounds to, for example, the library in college, blocking access to dorms, creating a pervasively hostile, threatening environment, perhaps true threats, you know, globalize the intifada, et cetera. And that what this legislation does is provide guidance as to how to define anti-Semitism, given that there is no definition that the Department of Education is statutorily supposed to use. So to take a step back, you know, why do you think that the both of you, what in the legislation sort of specifically attacks speech as opposed to interpreting existing law as it applies to actions?
Two points in response quickly. First of all, blocking access to the library or incitement or true threats, again, as I've just mentioned, none of those are protected. So the law adds nothing in that regard. What the law instead does add is a list of speech-specific, viewpoint-specific examples that administrators would be compelled to consider and act upon. And that's where the problem lies. Whether it's applied to conduct, in which case it's extraneous and superfluous and unnecessary, or applied to speech, as in the many examples that we are seeing here at FIRE, the impact is the same. You're introducing a viewpoint-based restriction. We know from Supreme Court precedent that these kinds of evidentiary nudges, a government thumb on the scale, are unconstitutional. Virginia v. Black, where the burning of a cross was considered prima facie evidence of racial hatred and a true threat, the court struck down that evidentiary inference as a threat to the First Amendment. So too here. The answer is for holistic, individualized, fact-based, context-specific determinations in every instance, just as it is with every other instance of alleged discriminatory harassment. We don't have a definition of anti-Black racism. We don't have a definition of Islamophobia or homophobia. We infer from the facts in a given instance what is at stake and whether discriminatory harassment has occurred and must be responded to. And that's what we should continue to do.
Eugene? You're on mute.
We don't have a definition of anti-black racism, but we have a long history of examples. And what we don't have, but perhaps we'd have to come up with rules like this, anti-Semitism, as this was kind of how I prefaced my comments, anti-Semitism is distinguished in history for always clothing itself in the rhetoric of reasons, right? In the rhetoric of, we're not just saying that Jews are bad, we want to say they're doing bad things, they're poisoning the wells, they're killing babies, they're spreading disease. That is a thing. I don't think anyone would get away with it if they said, you know, horrible things are being done in inner cities by inner city people, and we got to get rid of the inner city people. I never said anything about any race. I'm sure that is speech that would be punishable on campus. And this is where I think a small point in which I disagree with Will. He said that we've chosen another path, you know, another path from silence and speech. We have for a long time chosen another path, and then we made a little detour off the other path of free speech. And again, we're working in a framework in which I assume that civil rights laws, Title VI, as applied to education, do currently restrict speech that is viewpoint-based. You cannot say things that are offensive based on your viewpoint of racial groups being inferior in an educational context without potentially triggering a Title VI violation. I believe that speech perhaps should be protected. Maybe this is a misapplication, but that's the world we're in. The only question here is whether Jews get equal standing. Now, you might say, let's get rid of the whole thing. Okay, that's a discussion I'm willing to have. But in the meantime, Ira does not say, as with the cross-burning example, that criticizing Israel is prima facie evidence of anti-Semitism. Far from it. All it says is that it is possible that amongst many other manifestations of anti-Semitism, it must be at least considered that anti-Semitism can manifest in pathological, unique, discriminatory attitudes towards the country in which most of the world's Jews live and which is often identified with Jews. The alternative is to say that it can't be considered, is to say that this is exactly the kind of contextual analysis that I think Will calls for. Again, I don't actually think it's going to help much in practice. I think it's very hard to snuff these things out through restrictions. I don't think it's likely to be successful. In general, I think that it is a mistake for the Jewish community in America to think that they can hide behind these regulatory barriers from anti-Semitism. But were it to be passed, I don't think it would be problematic. And what does worry me is when it's being discussed, there's this pretense that Title VI does not, you know, otherwise regulate what you could describe as very nasty political speech, viewpoint-based speech about protected groups.
I certainly take your point, Eugene. For the nearly 20 years I've been working here at FIRE, we have consistently fought against broad applications of federal anti-discrimination law in both the Title VI and Title IX contexts used to restrict protected speech that, again, some might find racist or sexist or homophobic or otherwise hateful or hurtful, but nevertheless protected by the First Amendment. So I certainly take your point as to the enforcement failures of universities. But where I disagree and where I do think we part company is whether that failure thus justifies or calls for a doubling down on the regulatory framework. In fact, the introduction of a new element of the regulatory framework, a list of examples that include on their face viewpoints protected by the First Amendment. That is where I think an additional problem is introduced. The answer is not to increase possible regulatory spurs to censorship, but to ensure that the existing law is equally enforced, including to protect Jewish students, and to do so in a way that respects the First Amendment's high bar for speech that might be considered hateful. As FIRE is called for, we would like to see Title VI amended to explicitly include religion, to codify into law the longstanding recognition that shared ethnic origin or membership in a religious, predominantly religious nation can be grounds for discrimination, and to codify at last the Davis Standard into federal law. That way, we have an equal playing field for all. And then to ensure that those rules are fairly enforced, protective of speech and fairly enforced. I think that goes a long way to solving the problem in a constitutional way.
Is there, just to press the point, what in the legislation specifically says that speech that is deemed anti-Semitic by the IRA definition triggers Title VI? Doesn't the legislation say if you're trying to figure out whether actions, not speech, certain actions such as blocking a path or in on the quad, blocking access to the library, right? So if there's just somebody just blocking access to the library to people without saying anything, right? That doesn't violate Title VI. It only violates Title VI if people are being targeted for their race or going back decades, religion in certain circumstances. So what the proponents of the legislation say, what the legislation actually does say, is that the use of alternative definitions of anti-Semitism impairs enforcement efforts by adding multiple standards and may fail to identify many of the modern manifestations of anti-Semitism. And that's in a climate where around the country you see universities not enforcing the time, manner, and place rules with regard to demonstrations, political speech, perhaps, and applying double standards, perhaps best exemplified at the NN workforce hearing, where several college presidents told Representative Stefanik that they couldn't say whether or not calling for the genocide of Jews violates their campus speech codes. So sort of specifically to circle back, what is it in the legislation that specifically targets speech as opposed to saying if there's behavior that's problematic, and we're trying to figure out, does this behavior, is it just bad behavior we don't like, or is this specifically the type of bad behavior that implicates Title VI? We're trying to figure out how to apply that with regards to anti-Semitism. We think colleges have been doing that. Multiple definitions don't work. Here's a definition.
Because the definition, again, Aaron, specifically incorporates viewpoints. Look, if you have a student group that is using bullhorns at night next to a dorm the week of exams, if you have a student group that is blocking access and egress to a specific area of campus, if you've got a student group that's taken over an administrative building or the library, if you've got a student group that is attacking or intimidating, circling members of a protected class, you don't need this definition. And that would be true regardless of the protected class status at issue. My call is for equal enforcement. There's nothing in this definition that confines it solely to action. In fact, by including viewpoints in the list of examples, it invites the kinds of abuses that we're already seeing. The invocation of the IRA definition to justify investigations into nothing more than posting a petition online or inviting a speaker. Those are the kinds of outcomes that one can expect when one has a list of examples, again, explicitly identifying certain viewpoints for quote unquote consideration by administrators and determining whether something could contribute to a hostile environment. This is not to excuse the failures of universities to address discriminatory harassment against Jewish students on their campuses, but rather to question the means of addressing that behavior. I would argue that universities can and should enforce policies that are First Amendment compliant in ways that would address the behaviors you described. I think it's inevitable that a list of viewpoints that may be deemed anathema, may be deemed, to use your word, quote unquote, problematic, will be abused by university administrators. Nobody knows better than my organization the elasticity of such words with administrators who feel like they have a political need to crack down on unpopular speech. We've been fighting it for 20 years. This would add gasoline to the fire. It would not end the problem.
Yeah, Aaron, let me jump in here. I disagree with you a bit, but I think for the disagreement actually will illustrate why I think the law is not constitutionally problematic under the law. as it exists. What the law says is, in reviewing, investigating, or deciding whether there's been a violation of Title VI, based on an individual's actual or perceived shared Jewish ancestry or ethnic characteristics, the Department of Education shall take into consideration the definition of anti-Semitism in IHRA as part of its assessment of whether the practice was motivated by anti-Semitic intent. So the law doesn't actually say whether it applies to speech or conduct. It says what in investigating, determining whether there's been a violation of Title VI. So the question is, does Title VI require discriminatory conduct? And as I see the cases, unfortunately, you can have a Title VI violation, I think it's quite clear, through pure speech. I think, you know, speech about a racial group being inferior, about a racial group spreading disease, causing the world's problems, would potentially create a basis for a Title VI violation. But given that, how is it any different if those statements are from the river to the sea, Palestine must be free, which seems to call for mass murder of a particular group, Zionists are scum, when, you know, over 80% of Jews identify themselves as Zionists. For example, what if someone were to say Africans are horrible? It's true. Not all Africans are black. North Africans, South Africa. But I think those statements could all potentially be part of a... No.
Well, this is where we would disagree. I would argue that all those
under current law.
We have and will continue to argue that all such statements are and should be protected by the First Amendment, whether we're talking about from the river to the sea. Professor Volokh and I have an op-ed in the Los Angeles Times of some, let's see, 16 or so months ago, arguing that quote unquote calls for genocide are often, if not always, protected by the First Amendment unless they fall into one of these special exceptions, those narrow, limited exceptions to the First Amendment, true threats, incitement, and so forth, and they should be protected. So without going too deep into our op-ed, I'll just recommend interested folks check it out. It's on the Los Angeles Times website. And I think that just because there has been uneven enforcement in the past, introducing a viewpoint-based list of examples does not become any less problematic. We would argue that Africans are scum or Zionists are scum are absolutely protected by the First Amendment. Interestingly, to your point about conduct and speech, Judge Edith Jones, in an opinion, I want to say from 2023, in Speech First v. Fenves, noted in a footnote that the idea, as she put it, that Title IX, this is in the Title IX context, but obviously analogous here, that the idea that discriminatory harassment could be based on speech alone is inherently dubious, and that she questions whether the Supreme Court has ever provided evidence for such an interpretation. And I think that may be onto something. I think that pure speech taken alone to reach the Davis definition's bar of speech that is so severe, pervasive, and objectively offensive, it must be considered as part of a pattern of conduct that, again, is so targeted, so severe, pervasive, objectively offensive, that it denies the victim access to an educational opportunity to benefit. It may be possible that such speech could be shown in a given instance, but it would have to be a hell of a thing. I'd have to really see more than just pure speech.
E.G.?
Yeah, no, listen, as I've said before, as I think I've intimated before, I find Will's position attractive as a matter of first principle, but we don't live in Edith Jones, Eugene Volokh, Will Creeley world that I don't think that describes, you know, the general run of the cases. And given that there is a substantial wave of anti-Semitism, whether excluded, you know, it gets back to the, you know, there's a famous story about Robert Nozick, who had a house out on like Nantucket something. And it turns out there was a big scandal. It was rent stabilized, Robert Nozick's house. Robert Nozick, a great libertarian philosopher. And he was confronted with this. He said, of course, there should be no rent control. It's horrible. But in the meantime, right, do we use it or not? Again, I think in this case, it's politically ill-advised to use it in any case. But it's philosophically consistent to say that one should use the laws as they currently stand, while intellectually favoring systemic reform until that systemic that is to say that if there is rent stabilization, you should not, because of your philosophical views, be the one person not allowed to benefit.
Eugene, to that point, and first of all, I want to say I'm reminded every day that we don't live in a Will Creeley world. But I would argue about the general run of the cases, though. I think that for the past 30 years now, going back to the first speech codes at the University of Michigan, which were designed to address persistent anti-Black discrimination, those speech codes were very quickly marshaled against Black students who became some of the first to be investigated under them. I wonder what you think and what other folks who might be proponents of the law would think about the potential arms race that introducing such a list of definitions might spark. This is what I mean by a new framework here. There is no accepted definition of other discriminatory examples against other protected class statuses. It's my old colleague Joe Cohn, FIRE's former director of policy pointed out that if you were to do some, very quickly you would see calls for a list of examples of actionable Islamophobia that must be considered likewise by administrators. And I think, if I'm not mistaken, I should have this, I think at some point there was a push by Representative Ilhan Omar to introduce exactly such a list. So I think that what would happen as a practical result is the world of protected speech would grow smaller, that the viability of opinions that could be expressed without fear of investigation or punishment would be constrained and reduced. And I don't think that's a result that should be of interest to anybody, let alone civil libertarians like myself. So I think that we need to be very worried about possible ramifications of an attempt to address a perceived double standard in enforcement by opening up a new front for investigating and punishing speech that's protected by the First Amendment.
So expanding the prism a little bit to look at other laws incorporating the IRA definition in the States and the line between actions and speech, I wanted to ask you about anti-BDS laws as applied, for example, state-owned contract or invest with companies that are engaged in BDS, and whether that is regulating speech or specific actions. So Eugene, I'm going to start.
Sure. So first of all, the BDS laws, and I've been quite involved in them, they don't incorporate the IRA definition. The BDS laws are completely separate from the IRA definition. I'll tell you what the typical state anti-BDS law does is say if a company, BDS stands for Boycott, Discrimination, and Sanctions, which is a name for a movement to restrict economic activity with Israel or Jews in Israel. And the what BDS essentially calls for is refusals to deal in the business context, commercial refusals to deal. We're in the same place here. I would say that civil rights laws restricting commercial refusals to deal, i.e. requiring people to do business with people who they find objectionable on the grounds of their race, religion, etc., raise serious free association problems. That's the fundamental point of Richard Epstein in Forbidden Grounds. Nonetheless, they are very well established that one may in fact have to not refuse business with people because of these protected traits. So there are currently executive orders in many states, and a federal executive order, I believe, is still on the books, that says if you boycott people because of their sexual orientation, you're not eligible for state or federal contracts. So what the BDS laws, and I was involved in some of their authorship, so I know a bit of the story, are actually modeled on some of those LGBT protections, that if you boycott a company because of its connection to Israel. Again, a company is not Israel. A company is not a political entity. Because of its Israeli identity, its connection to Israel, You can do so. You're free to do so, but you will be ineligible for state contracts. Now, the boycotting a company is an activity. That is a commercial activity. It is a business activity. And I think the proof of that is it can be done for different ideological reasons. A company can boycott an Israeli company because they hate Israelis or because they're being pressured by protesters in front of their corporate headquarters to do so. So, for example, if a company refuses to deal with an Israeli company and, you know, still sings Hatikva every day, the Israeli national anthem, that falls within the BDS law because it's a refusal to deal. On the other hand, a company that says, I hate Israel, makes all the workers trample over the Israeli flag, but does not make these refusals to deal, that does not fall within the BDS law because one is speech, the other is action.
Well,
let me first of all say FIRE takes no position on the BDS movement. We take no position on any of the speech we defend. We've certainly defended proponents of BDS calling for boycotts. It's classic protected speech. But we do and have and will continue to argue that institutional adoption of BDS is dramatically at odds with academic freedom, that individual professors, students have to be free to make up their own minds. And an institutional boycott of a nation, be it Israel or any other nation, is antithetical to the global interconnected search for truth that academic freedom enables. So we've been clear on that as other organizations have shifted their positions on such a question. That being said, I think we part company again, Eugene, with regard to what constitutes economic activity and what constitutes protected expression. I would cite former chairman of FIRE's board, Daniel Shuchman, who wrote, I think, a very perceptive opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal last year, arguing that the implications of the state using its power to penalize independent viewpoints is serious and should be a cause for concern amongst folks who, like Mr. Shuchman, support Israel. That there's a no foreign policy purpose ultimately served beyond political signaling, and that such political signaling can shift with political winds and can be used to punish Israel and its supporters in the future. So I recommend that viewpoint.
For sure, by the way, for sure. A state could just as easily boycott Israel subject to foreign affairs preemption. But So far, these laws have been upheld by the few courts that have gotten to final rulings on them. It was upheld by the en banc Eighth Circuit. And the basic rationale is, you know, the levels in which these have been considered, you know, the appellate level would be the highest. They're stuck in the world as it is, not the world the world as it should be. And it's quite clear that you know, it's very hard to differentiate between a refusal to deal with people because they're Israeli and a refusal to deal with people because of their race or other protected class, which clearly the government can regulate and regulates much more severely. So if we were in a world where these LGBT contracting laws have been challenged and struck down, then certainly the BDS laws would also be constitutionally problematic. In fact, these LGB contracting laws, as far as I have not even been challenged, as far as I've been able to be found. And so the world as it is provides a very strong strong support for this. Again, and if we're to start erasing the world as it is, I would want to see that be done thoroughgoingly. Not, you know, on the last in, first out principle.
Yeah, I thought the Eighth Circuit got it right the first time. FIRE participated as amicus in support of the First Amendment challenge to Arkansas's anti-BDS law, both into the panel and then to the en banc Eighth Circuit. It goes back to, I think, your point early on about your mentor, Professor Epstein, and the consideration of individual rights and larger anti-discrimination legislation. I think, for example, of the court's recent ruling, which I was just talking talking to FIRE's very bright undergraduate interns about a few weeks ago in 303 Creative. And I, again, while those cases have, I think, legal and factual differences with what we're discussing here, I think the underlying point vis-a-vis the right of the individual contractor to hold and express political viewpoints or viewpoints about protected classes without formal government sanction or threat of punishment must be the prevailing view here in the United States under the First Amendment. So again, taking your point about descriptive reality and doctrinal clarity, I continue in my role here as legal director for FIRE to insist on maximum protection for the First Amendment.
We'll take some questions from the audience. One came in, don't you think diminishing anti-Semitism cannot be accomplished just legally, but must be inculcated into the culture and curriculums of schools, campuses, institutions all the time by advancing it constantly, just as pro-Palestinian forces have done for the last 20 years? It seems anti-Semitic and pro-Jewish Israel themes must be constantly advanced and repeated so they become part of cultural, political, and sociological thesis and attitude.
Look, I'm not a cultural change kind of guy. That is to say, I think what was described. So I do agree that legal mechanism, certainly the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act, I don't think is a significant mechanism of changing anti-Semitic attitudes, which is why I don't see much value in it, even though I think it would not be unconstitutional under current law if passed. At the same time, using the educational system to inculcate views is really horrible thing for the government to do. In fact, it does do it already, and that's really bad. But I don't think it would also be effective because we've had 50 years of Holocaust education to what seems little avail. It's just not clear that this actually works. At the same time, to the extent that there is, if you say, pro-Palestinian brainwashing in public schools, I would start by resisting those efforts very directly, rather than trying to come up with curricula. And here I'll get to the point of, who it empowers. One reason I don't like the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act is it just empowers further civil rights enforcers on campus who are not our friends. And we'll never be our friends. And additional curricula only empower educational bureaucracies run by teachers' unions, which are never our friends. And no matter how you write them, they will not be used well. So send your kids to private school.
Let me jump in here and say I very much take and share Eugene's concern about indoctrination of students with any political view, let alone one's preferred political view or its antithesis. I think that kind of indoctrination is, again, at odds with longstanding First Amendment principle. So I would not trade one orthodoxy for another, perceived or actual. But I would, I think, part company with Eugene vis-a-vis the importance of education. Speaking broadly, I side with my friend Ken Stern, again, the lead author of the IRA definition, who has testified eloquently before Congress as to the power of educational efforts to speak across difference or sloganeering or entrenchment on one political side or the other. At Bard, where Ken works as director of the study of the Center of Hate, or Center for the Study of Hate, I think that's the right name for it. He has lamented the fact that institutions have failed to educate students in the conflict in the Middle East and should, in fact, use their strength and their purpose as educational institutions to do so. So while I don't agree with inculcation or indoctrination, I think that a reassertion of the educational function of institutions in line with my ethos of more speech is the best way forward. So that's what I would say to that good question.
So follow-up question in the Q&A for Will is if a racist opens a restaurant and says he's boycotting anyone who supports interracial relationships, and as a result, he excludes or kicks out interracial couples because they implicitly support interracial relationships, do you think that penalizing this individual or even just the state refusing to contract with that person would violate the First Amendment? And if not, how can we distinguish that boycott from boycotting anyone with associations with Israel?
I'd like to thank the questioner for the good question and recognize and acknowledge that I brought this upon myself by invoking 303 creative in an answer. I stepped right into the briar patch. But I would say that there's a difference between a restaurant. I would say there's a difference between protected class status and criticism of the state of Israel. Again, acknowledging Eugene's point and the persistent point that in the eyes of many, Israel and Judaism are interchangeable and intertwined, but not always. There was an interesting op-ed this week by a student who's Israeli who said under IRA he has less right to criticize his government than he would actually back home in Israel, and was concerned about that implication here. So I will just put aside the questions of common carrier law and the intersection of anti-discrimination public accommodations law and leave that over here for the moment, just to say that I think there is a difference with regard to criticism of a nation state.
Either of you like to comment as to how this administration and the prior administration have been enforcing Title VI at universities as well as K through 12 education?
Yeah, I'm happy to jump in there. I'm gravely concerned about the introduction of this concept of aggregated or cumulative hostile environment harassment started in the Biden administration, continued with vigor by the current administration. The idea that there's an amalgamation, a kind of collective accumulation of individual instances of protected speech that when taken in the whole in the aggregate can somehow constitute hostile environment harassment such that an institution has to take action. To me, that prompts the fundamental question of when an institution can take action against an individual instance of protected speech. How are they to know when such protected speech taken as a whole has somehow tipped the scale and requires remediation? I think that's a recipe for censorship, and we've seen that. And then specifically with regard to the current administration, I am gravely concerned by its failure to follow Title VI is implementing regulations which require a series of steps before funding can be cut. This administration has abandoned those implementing regulations and acted lawlessly in ways that I think threaten core First Amendment values. For more on that view, I invite readers to check out Fire's amicus brief in the Harvard litigation and also in the Columbia litigation.
I want to just go back to the earlier point for a minute, because I think Will touched on something very crucial. So the real difference in pushing back on the example of the racist restaurateur, that Israel is a nation state. So Israel happens to be a nation state. Let's say there was no Israel, and let's say we were back in the era of Henry Ford, and we were just talking about the global Jewish cabal. We're not against Jews. We're against this political thing called the global Jewish cabal. Global Jewish cabal, the international Jew, is itself a political entity. It is a political entity that predates the state of Israel and maybe has always existed, right, in the eyes of those who believe in it. So by simply latching on to this political entity, one can essentially insulate anti-Semitism cleverly from civil rights protection. It's just I'm anti-Zionist, but in the vigor, particularity, loudness, and unequal application of one's criticisms of a particular political entity, make clear that it is a form of attack on Jewishness. For example, let's say the basic claim, Israel should not exist as a political state, political nation. It's a respectable opinion if you don't believe in nation states. Right? But what if you actually, what if it's the only nation state that you don't believe has a right to exist? Then it becomes very hard to conclude that it is not, may not be, and that's all the IRA definition requires you to think, may not be about because of the majority ethnic composition of that state. Just like if I said, China doesn't have a right to exist. Maybe because it's the China, maybe. Not as a government, but as a state.
Well,
I guess all I would say in response is that, again, it's a fundamental baseline, though the First Amendment would protect broad criticisms of any number of protected classes and does protect it, whether that's anti-Black racism. There's Blacks are a problem, or gays are a problem, or there's an international gay cabal, or whatever the case may be. So if the problem here is that Zionism becomes this useful pretext for excusing anti-Jewish hate, well, the anti-Jewish hate is protected whether it's couched in the language of anti-Zionism or not, right? That still is the bottom line assumption here. So I don't think it's a clever evasion of the First Amendment. It's bottom line protection so much as an illustration of it. But we could talk here for quite a while.
Eugene, anything to close?
No, I think that's actually a good close.
Great. Well, on behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank our speakers for the benefit of their time and expertise today. Thank you also to the audience members who joined us. We greatly appreciate your participation. Check out our website, fedsoc.org, or follow us on all major social media platforms at FedSoc to stay up to date with announcements and upcoming webinars. Thank you once more for tuning in. And with that, we are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to Necessary and Proper. If you enjoyed this podcast, please tell a friend, and don't forget to subscribe on iTunes or Google Play. To learn more about the Article I initiative, please visit fedsoc.org/articlei. That's fedsoc.org/articlei.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.